Accession number 28498, Reel 4.
David Wright, Reel 4.
Could you tell me what the kind of living conditions for you pilots was on board HMS Maplin?
Oh, well, we'd an officer's cabin. Actually, we shared a cabin on the one I just recently mentioned with Benji Manicus. I shared a cabin with Benji. There were only two of us aboard then. A previous convoy, there had been three of us aboard with Johnny Walker and so on. But our function was only in daylight hours. So at night we could read magazines right there to do what I wanted. With early call, it depended on what time of year, you know, dawn. But we were in the cockpit by dawn, and we were in the cockpit until dusk, but in shifts. So I can only, harking back all these years, say it was boring. It was damn boring.
What did you do when you were sitting in the cockpit? Because was it 2 hour shifts that you would do?
2 hours, right. 2 hours. Well, that last one with Benji was 2 hours on, 2 hours off, interchanging with Benji. I wrote letters, and I've always had this turn of, you know, doggerel stuff. And I know that it was sitting there that I composed the two which eventually came into the Fleet Arm anthem called the A-25. It's rude. Do you mind if I say something rude? We were rude then, you know. When you're 20, a lad at 20, your testosterone is going. And so I composed poetry, either to my girlfriends or, in this case, I remember this particular thing, and it goes, I don't know if I can say this. I sat in the cockpit. I sat on the squirter. We called it a squirter, the catapult. Well, it squirted us off, didn't it? I sat on the squirter, awaiting the kick, passing the time by caressing my stick. Down went the blue flag. The thing gave a cough. "Call funk me," cried Benji. He tossed himself off. Cracking shell. It's awfully rude, isn't it? But that's what we were like at that age. And so we were relaxed. We were very relaxed.
Was a lot of, as you say, that age, was that a lot to do with how you behaved and looked at life at that time?
Yes, I think. We were an irresponsible lot. I've said before, we were playboys. Who else, you know, was given an aeroplane to fly? An expensive piece of machinery. It was glamorous. And our uniform in the Navy was more glamorous than the RAF. An RAF officer didn't have a uniform. You know, gold braid, gold, you know. We wore our wings on the sleeve, not up here. It was a glamorous life, and the birds, popsies, they figured large in our thoughts. It's what to do with testosterone.
What kind of durations would you do when you were doing these, the escorting the convoys, say, in the Western Approaches and out into the Atlantic?
Oh, we only escorted convoys, as I mentioned, until the convoy was out of range of enemy aircraft. And usually, that could be, if the convoy was going to America, 2 or 3 days out from Belfast, or Liverpool, or Glasgow. And then we diverted to meet an incoming convoy, and 2 or 3 days coming back. So they weren't of long duration. We didn't sail all the way to America. We didn't sail all the way to Russia. What we did do, I believe my last convoy was to Gibraltar. We sailed all the way to Gibraltar. I don't know why. Maybe it was more to... Why Gibraltar?
Would you have been in range of aircraft, though, for most of that journey if you did a...
Oh, that's why. That's why. Whilst the convoy was in range of enemy aircraft, we were there to protect it. When it out, we were surplus requirements. So we came back, or were diverted to another convoy elsewhere. So they weren't long trips.
At the time you were going, though, obviously you did the Arctic convoys, and it was in the winter time. What were conditions like sitting in the cockpit and on board ship at that time?
Bloody cold. Well, I suppose we were aware then that if we were to ditch there or bail out and come down to the sea, 10 to 15 minutes was the maximum we'd have because of hypothermia. But funny enough, you don't dwell on that. It doesn't occupy your mind all that much, but if you were questioned at the time, which you weren't, but if you were, you'd be aware that you wouldn't be picked up pretty quickly. I have a pal who lives in New Zealand called Gordon Rees, who was still alive, he's older than me. And he ditched on the trip to Murmansk, but he was picked up within 15 minutes. Now, he ditched because he had engine failure. He couldn't choose and climb to 2,000 feet and, have a nice casual bailout. Suddenly, he did that engine, and he was flying low anyway. And so he was into the water within almost seconds of his engine failure. And he had no option. But he was picked up within 15 minutes. He said it was bloody cold. But he's alive today.
What was the procedure to pick up a pilot once he'd bailed out? Did you have a special boat attached to the...
Well, to begin with, you're sitting on your parachute, but there's also a little inflatable dinghy. Now, if you can, of course, the dinghy automatically inflates and you get in the dinghy, which is some protection. But the procedure always at sea is to look for a ship, any ship, a fishing ship, any ship, and ditch or bail out somewhere within reach of that ship. And they'll pull you aboard one way or another, or the lower boat will pull you aboard. So there was a lot of feeling and confidence that you would be picked up. You wouldn't be left in the middle of the Atlantic alone.
You mentioned, obviously, it being cold in the cockpit. What were you wearing in the way of flying gear?
Oh, you want to see it? I've still got it, my flying jacket. It's leather, fur-lined. The usual RAF Battle of Britain. You've seen them running the siren. Well, that same thing.
Is that the Irwin jacket?
Yeah, the Irwin jacket. With flying boots, fur-lined, everything's fur-lined. We had pure silk gloves and then thick gauntlets on top. And there was a lot of good clothing to protect, you know, in the cockpit. But not really, there was no protection against the water.
Did you wear any other layers underneath your...
I suppose I'd wear a vest, I don't know. I can't remember that. And of course we had a Mae West, you know, the... You're pretty sure you're not going to drown if you get free of the aeroplane and you're free of the parachute. You're not going to drown.
Would that have been the fear more to actually be trapped in the aircraft? Is that really why it was developed as the bailing out system?
No, it was developed to bail out instead of ditch because Bob Everett ditched twice and the second time he lost his life. And we realised then that a Hurricane, I'm talking about a Hurricane aircraft, that's all, has this oil cooler and it shovels water, so it somersaults the aeroplane over. So you're getting out of the cockpit upside down, and with a jettisoned hood, it's filling the water as well. You're going to be lucky if you survive by ditching, proved by Bob Everett having lost his life doing it. But if you're going to have engine failure, there's no option, you can't choose.
You mentioned, obviously, after your last trip, that the system with America coming into the war was becoming obsolete.
Yeah.
What happened to you once were no longer on...
Well, I was a junior pilot for 804 Squadron, and when it was realised that the life of, or the function of camp ships wasn't going to last much longer, because presumably there was knowledge that aircraft carriers or pocket aircraft carriers from America would be arriving. A new squadron was formed, 702, and I was made CO of 702 with one other pilot who had never been to sea called Bill Sturgis, and with three aeroplanes and 11, I think it was, mechanics, airframe and so on. And it was the smallest squadron in the fleet air arm. And it lasted the shortest duration. So I have the dubious honour of being CEO of a squadron in the fleet now for that brief time. And I and Sturgis, Bill Sturgis, staffed the ship for the... And we're only talking 3 months, that's all. Very brief. So that was the end, really. So 702 didn't really perform a function.
Where did you go to after 702? What was your next point?
On leave. I was on leave. Now, after that, I was appointed then to another squadron, 893, which was equipped with American Grumman Wildcat F4F aeroplanes, and going to be ship-based, and we didn't know at the time, but eventually the aircraft carrier, which is a proper full Pucker fleet carrier, was actually most formidable, a full deck. And we worked up, that's a term used for getting a squadron to work as a whole unit, formation, flying and everything like that, at a place called Donnybristol, Firth of Forth, to work as a team. And because I'd had previous experience flying operational, I was given a flight, and I was the leader of Green Flight. There are three flights in a squadron, and I was leading Green Flight. So I got a number one, a number two, and one in the box. There were four of us, you see. And working up means preparing to fight a war in the air based on the carrier. So we did dummy deck landings at a place called Arbroath in Scotland, where a runway was marked with white paint like a carrier's deck. So you train for precision landing. There are wires across on a carrier. At Arbroath there weren't wires, but there was a white line across. Six white lines, and you've got to catch one of those wires on a carrier, that's the case. And so we did a lot of rehearsing to do spot landings, you'd call it today, or precision landings. A different technique in that you come in fairly low with power on, and as you're coming over the roundout, the stern of the carrier, or the end of the runway in this case, chop the throttle so the aeroplane immediately stalls and it's a short landing. And you get very conversant on making short landings. Until, of course, the day when you have to do a real one.
Did you use a batsman during your
deployment? Oh, yes. Oh, yes, there was a batsman on the end. And his arms indicate to you in the cockpit coming in whether you're too high or too low. And if he's doing that, it means go up a bit, put power on.
So he raises his arms.
He raises them. If he lowers them, it means knock some throttle off. Descend more, you see. I'll put some more, you haven't enough flap on. Something to descend more quickly. And that's, he's seeing your angle of approach as you come in, you see. You can't see that, but he can, and he can tell you, you're going to overshoot, you're going to undershoot. So he indicates by his bats in his outstretched arms what attitude you have to adopt to touch down at his feet, virtually. So a lot of, that's the working up, a lot of rehearsal. As I said, then, until the first day, you've got to do it for real. And when all the squadron was ready to embark aboard HMS Formidable, I finished camp ships now, by the way. They've gone. first time aboard was not in HMS Formidable. There were two other training carriers, Furious and Argus, and they were in Scapa Flow. And we were to do a landing aboard there. So that's our first for real, with a ship, an aircraft carrier, steaming into wind, with a white steam jet in the bows, showing you that that's going right down the middle of the carrier's deck, which means, you know, it's into wind, so you've no drift. And you do what you did on the... follow the batsman. Eventually, we ignored the batsman, you know, we thought we were too good for him. But those days, you do what the batsman, if he says you're too high, you obey him. And sure enough, we caught a wire and that was that. I think we did perhaps three landings, training, and then the squadron, the whole squadron then, embarked on our mothership, which was HMS Formidable. And we did that opposite Ailsa Craig, you know, the, what's it called, going up to Glasgow? Firth of Clyde. And I was, as I previously said, in charge of Green Flight. Airline Pearson, that was his nickname, because before the war, He used to take people on 5-shilling flights from Southport Beach. He was the CO. And then Algy MacDonald was a senior pilot. And so, first of all, airline went in with his three, all successfully. And then it was Algy MacDonald to take his three in. And we were all circling, watching. I had my men all in formation on me. And Algy went over the side and it was round. I don't know why. None of us know why. I mean, he'd done it before. Not in the ship, but it must have been tense or something. But he was drowned. So it was up to me to lead our three in. And fortunately, I did it right and we landed. And so we're all aboard.
When you landed on an aircraft carrier, is it a succession of arrestor wires? And do you try and get the first one or the middle one or the one nearest?
Which wire? It's a wire. There are, in fact, seven wires. Formidable. A fleet carrier, that's a big carrier. Like Ark Royal, you know, the big ones. And it doesn't matter which you catch, but the six wires, the first six wires, are all tensioned just the same. But ahead of the wires, there's a steel rope barrier. That means that if you don't catch a wire at all, you crash into the barrier, which will damage the aeroplane, but not you. But most important, it doesn't damage all aeroplanes that are parked ahead, that have landed ahead of you. And so there are six wires that are normal, but the seventh wire is a very tight wire, because there isn't much room before the barrier. And we always call that the Christ Almighty wire. And I've caught the Christ Almighty wire, and it pulls you up. That's deceleration, not acceleration. So I don't know which wire. Nowadays, they tell me that pilots can say, I'm going to catch wire number two, and they do. It's totally different. We were flying by the seat of our pants. Nowadays, you have so many electronic aids, it's different.
What was the sensation of deceleration that you got when the hook catches a wire?
Well, before you're approaching, when you're doing your downwind leg, and the ship, you're seeing the ship over on your left shoulder all the time, first of all, you tighten all your harness. You've been fairly loose to be comfortable in the cockpit, but you tighten everything up to prepare for deceleration. And it's not bad. You don't black out. It's a jerk. You know. And it, like a car safety harness in a car, if you suddenly put the brakes on, you go forward. A bit like that. Not uncomfortable.
Is there always a sense of relief with that, catching the wire?
I suppose yes, but in my case, and in most people's case, there was a more important sensation. When you're operating from an aircraft carrier, the aircraft carrier is one ship of a fleet. There are destroyers, cruisers, battleships maybe, all sorts of other things. And when you're landing on a carrier, the carrier has to be steaming into wind. Why? Because let's suppose there's a wind blowing of 30 mile an hour. If you're steaming into wind, you're speed over the sea or the carrier deck is 30 mile an hour slower. So if your stall speed, let's say, is 80 miles an hour, you can effectively come over the round arm to land at 50 miles an hour over the ground because there's 30 mile an hour of wind blowing. So because the whole fleet has to steam into wind, you don't want to be spending much time fiddling about landing on, if there's a whole squadron of you, or if there's a whole flight. So the one of the big disciplines is to get on quick, all the lot of you. And I can be proud to tell you that Green Flight, the affordable, still holds, well, the ship's wrecked now, it's at Breakers Yard, the record for the shortest interval to get all four aeroplanes aboard. All four aeroplanes in 47 seconds. How's that? For me, easy, because I was in first. But number four behind, he's the worst, because we're all up one another's slipstream, right? Up one another's arse going in. Down with the wire, over the barrier, up the barrier, another one on. Down with the barrier, another one on. And within that, in 47 seconds. And that's the record. So when you ask me a question, what's it like, the relief? the relief is, are we all in, and you look up at the bridge to see what wings command are flying, you know, when there's applauding or when they're saying, you know, come and see me. different priority.
What was the Wildcat like? Can you again give me a thumbnail sketch as you've given with other aircraft, as an aircraft to fly and its handling characteristics?
Well, unlike the other aircraft I've described to you, the Wildcat was built for carrier flying. American built. Grumman. And it was very sturdy. It had its vices and nuisances. The undercarriage, for example, wasn't hydraulic. You had to wind it, crank it up with a handle. And it was 28 turns, I can still remember that, to get the wheels up and 28 turns to get the wheels down. It had to be done manually. Apart from that, though, it was built for bouncing onto a deck. You could fairly thump it down. Sturdy wheels. Fairly narrow, but it didn't matter if you caught a wire. When you've caught a wire and a carrier in the fleet arm, your landing's finished. You don't have to do anything except switch the engine off. When you're landing in an RFY, you're landing on an aerodrome, and you touch down, the landing is not finished. And this is one of the pitfalls that we had. If we'd been flying a lot from a carrier, and then we disembark in Malta or Alexandria, whatever we did, and to work from an aerodrome, there are a lot of ground loops on those first landings, because as soon as you've touched down, particularly with an aeroplane with a narrow undercarriage, you have to fight a lot to keep it straight. Any side wind, crosswind, and you what they call ground loop. So it's a lot easier in that sense landing on an aircraft carrier than landing on an aerodrome.
Was it a manoeuvrable little aircraft?
Oh yeah, very manoeuvrable. Very manoeuvrable. But mind you, there's always something superseded it. And there was the Hellcat, which was better. And, you know, there's always, well, now the jets, now talk now with a propeller aircraft. Because there's a rotation, there's torque, and it tends to pull one way, things like that. But it was a very manoeuvrable aeroplane, and not a high-speed aeroplane. A little boxy sort of thing, stubby.
Was there a difference, because you mentioned it was designed for carriers,
yeah.
Was there a difference between sort of British and American aircraft that were used on carriers, in the sense of design-wise?
America has always been ahead of us producing aircraft for carrier work. The Corsair, they're all designed, all American. Even now, I mean, you see, it doesn't apply now. We have the Harrier, which is a jump jet. It doesn't need, it can hover. It's a helicopter. So we're in a different era now. We don't have to design aeroplanes to do what was necessary to design for them. The jet engine has altered all sorts of things. We now have ski jumps, which means it throws you into air. That we didn't have in those days. It was always a question of treating the carrier deck like an aerodrome.
But they designed, did they, specifically for carrier landing?
They designed their aeroplanes for carrier landing. A lot more carriers, a lot more aeroplanes, so...
Because you did mention, obviously, what happened with the Sea Fire. Was that basically because that was, unlike the Wildcat, that would have been a land aircraft?
Oh, it was.
That was developed.
Mitchell designed that as a land. They didn't design it for the Navy. No, it was... during the war... all the aeroplanes were not designed for the purpose until America came into war. They were designed for another purpose, and the Navy took second role in aeroplanes. The cast-offs of others, really.
We kind of left off the narrative when you were working up aboard the carrier. And embarking on board. Where did you go to from that when you'd embarked on board?
Well, the purpose of being a member of an air group was, of course, imminent invasion, or imminent pursuing the war. And this, in fact, was when the Allied forces, first of all, took the offensive rather than the defensive. And the offensive was to invade, not to defend, invade. And we invaded the underbelly of Europe. America's now with us, of course. And the first part, and first invasion, is North Africa. Once the bases there are established, then you could get bases in Sicily, Italy, and that's what happened. And then the army took over and advanced through Europe. But this was the first time that our war had gone on the offensive, and America were with us. And my ship, Formidable, was allocated the part of the North African coast of Algeria, Oran and Algiers. And it was decided that they were invading a French owned part of the world, that if the French had thought this was a British invasion, they would fight. But if they thought it was an American invasion, they would accept America rather than Britain. We're still today, France and Britain, you know, we're not friends. So when we came to do this invasion, we painted all our airplanes under American colours. And mostly the airplanes, they called them roundels, red, white and blue rings on the circle, painted on the side. Well, they were all painted out, and a white star was painted on, which the Americans, to distinguish American aircraft. So I flew an American aircraft in American colours. And it worked, because the Charge d'Affaires in Algiers, he capitulated after about 3 or 4 days, thinking that it was an American invasion. So it worked. But I tell my American associates that I once flew as an American.
What type of operations were you flying during the North African landings?
Well, a fighter aeroplane, basically. There were more than one squadron aboard. There were two squadrons of Wildcats, which the Navy used to call Martlets. And there was a squadron of Sea Fires, Spitfires. They couldn't fold the wings, so they had to be stuck on deck, and they were put on outriggers hanging over the sea. And then there was a squadron of Albacores, which were the torpedo airplanes. Our function as fighters was either to escort the Albacores, who were on a torpedo mission, a torpedoing U-boats or the Italian Navy or whatever it's going to be, or umbrellas over the fleet to protect the fleet from enemy aircraft, fighters or bombers, coming in, or to cover the actual landing, the troops who were doing the dirty work of landing. That was the role of fighter aeroplanes. Addition to that, perhaps, a little bit of what they call AS patrol, anti-submarine patrols, when we ranged far away looking for U-boats. Not that we could have done much to them. Bullets from the wings of a fighter aeroplane wouldn't damage a U-boat, but the radio could soon fetch a destroyer up or an albacore with a torpedo. So that was the function of the fighter squadrons aboard aircraft carriers.